Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast. I am one of your hosts. I'm John Bruford. I had to check my ID for a second there to check that I'm not Fenton Costello, but I'm not, because you are.
I am indeed. Hello, John.
Hello, Fenton. I was just mulling with you just before we were talking about movie deaths, and I mentioned that one of my all-time favorite movie deaths is in The Matrix.
And which one's that?
Well, do you know what? I can't remember the character's name, but it's in the first chunk where, you know, they're in the building and Neo sees the cat and he's like, oh, that's weird. What is it? It's a glitch in the Matrix, etc. That's that chunk, I think. Or it might be when Matey Boy goes rogue. But the that's it. He's unplugging people. He's back on the ship and he's gone nuts. And he's unplugging people and all that shit. Then it's the woman who just, she just looks up at, what's her name, Carrie Ann Moss, and she just goes, not like this. I just thought it was really beautifully done. It's just really nicely put. It's a really nice phrase. Not like this. We've been fighting for ages. What a shitty way to die. Because one of my mates isn't one of my mates. He'd rather have an imaginary steak. Douche. This leads me into where I was thinking about taking conversation today. It's just slightly out, far, far out of left field. Are you familiar with Buffy? Are you familiar with Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
My wife is a major Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan. She thinks any woman who can roundhouse kick in a pair of high heels is an absolute hero.
And that's very, very fair. Lorna, the lady that did our graphic design, my stepdaughter, she did our podcast branding, is also a colossal Buffy fan. Absolutely. And she grew up with it. You know, it's perfect time for her. But I'm actually talking about the movie, not the series.
Ah, okay. Yes, I'm familiar with the movie.
So the movie is much maligned, and I get it.
Really?
Yeah, it is. It really is. People hate it. They don't even count it as part of the same stable. But like the movie, like I had it on in the background while I was working this morning, and it actually holds up really well. It's on Disney Plus now. Phenomenal. But it holds up really well. Even the politics and the environment jokes hold up really well, because we're still worrying about the same things now. But I think the movie's got problems. But the problems are that it's too good at what it does. Because Buffy in the movie is this airhead, vapid, bimbo type, head cheerleader, complete cliche stereotype. And so it's much harder to root for her, because you actually would quite like her to die. And, you know, and they massively toned that down for the series. She's much more a regular teenager. But, you know, the movie's like, she's almost too good at it. And she's played by an actor called Christy Swanson, who, like, around the 86, 87, she was she was either a support in some very, very good movies or a lead in a couple of movies, some of which were good, some of which were terrible. She's in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, actually. She has the wonderful line where she's like, one of the teachers asking where Ferris is, and she has this wonderful line about, oh, my sister's boyfriend's cousin's best friend saw him at the thingy, what's it? And that's her. That's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And so she did a bunch of stuff. And then she did Buffy in 91, 92. But she's too good at doing the bimbo stuff, I think. And I think that goes against it, because it goes so far into camp with the exaggerated stereotypes that it makes it a much less relatable thing, as much as a teenager kicking vampire ass can be relatable. But it also has a great death scene with Paul Rubens, who has a wonderful line just before it, where he's had his arm ripped off earlier in the thing, and he's saying to Buffy, he's saying, we can do anything, we're immortal. And she just looks at him and goes, okay, then clap. But so I was watching this movie, right? And I was thinking,
is this going somewhere?
That movie, like sometimes you see a movie and it's got loads of talent that comes up in later years. Like Dazed and Confused is one, you know. But Buffy the Vampire Slayer has an absolutely ridiculous amount of talent in it. And some of it with just one line here and there. Some of these names, even you will know. So we've got Christy Swanson in the lead, you know. Somebody might recognize her. We've got Stephen Root, who's in Dodgeball and is one of the leads in the series Barry. He's wonderful. He's a hell of a talent. Donald Sutherland, he's one of the leads. Rutger Hauer is the lead vampire. Pee-wee Herman, what's it, Rubens? He's his sidekick. But in the little supporting roles, Hilary Swank, double Oscar winner Hilary Swank, plays one of the most vapid airheads in it. And, of course, she's a friend of the podcast in a way because she was the next Karate Kid and has almost certainly seen Cobra Kai. And then you got David Arquette is in it, a very young David Arquette. And Thomas Jane has a tiny, tiny, tiny part in it under a different name. And my two favorites, Ben Affleck has one line. He's threatened by a vampire on a basketball court. And Alexis Arquette has, I think it's a non-speaking role as a DJ. Alexis Arquette being David Arquette and Rosanna and Patricia Arquette's. How do you deal with this one? He was their brother when this was filmed, but later became their sister and then died very young, sadly.
Okay.
And one time, this is totally bizarre, and this is going to sound made up, but bear with me, right? I was out on the lash with a couple of mates when I was living in London, and we ended up back at one of their flat. We were pissed up drunk. We were watching TV and there's some late night magazine show on. And this is 20, 22, 23 years ago. And there was this thing on it about Alexis Arquette, who had set up some kind of quite a small church of sorts. And he was teaching his disciples how to worship. And worship consisted of taking some dethorned roses, a bunch of them, putting them in your ass, and then self-fellating.
Okay. Not for everyone, I guess. It's the choir taste.
Speak for yourself. But I think, at some point in that, you're going to be saying, oh, my God, whether it's good or bad, you know, God is going to come into the conversation. Yeah, sorry. So I had Buffy the Vampire Slayer on my mind, and it's available on Disney Plus now.
Your movie knowledge is in depth.
Useless. It's useless.
I know. If there's a pub quiz, like you want John for the movies, like that's a given. All right, you've got that covered.
Do you know the question that always comes up in pub quizzes though? Who's the first million-dollar actor? It's a fucking annoying question. There's no right answer, unfortunately.
Really?
Because a lot of pub quizzes will say it's Charlie Chaplin, and a lot of other pub quizzes will say it's Fatty Arbuckle. And actually, they could both probably claim it. Just depends which. Mind you, I was in a pub quiz the one time, and there was that Human League question, but it wasn't the Human League. Blokes next to us got credited the Human League. The answer was actually Philip Oakey and Giorgio Moroder.
Bastards.
I know, it was the one time we could have beaten them as well. It all hinged on that question.
Wow.
I'm still bitter about it. I bought it with one of them about a week ago as well, so I'm in the stream. I really did. I'm a terrible human. And it's always, I'm glad you're not angry about it. I'm fucking livid. It's 25 years ago. I'm livid.
It burns.
It does.
It's what fuels me.
Well, they had a specialist like pub quiz team. They won everything they entered, and this was the one time. We were just a bunch of piss heads, and we just had a golden week. We just absolutely flew. And we lost by a fucking point.
Outrageous.
And a lot of it was because we were so pissed off that they were given that one. I mean, he made a good argument. He's like, yeah, but it's on the best of the Human League. Yeah, but it's not credited to the Human League. The question was about Together in Electric Dreams. I didn't say where the brackets were then, but, you know. Anyway, how are you? All right.
I'm good, mate. I'm good. I'm just sitting here dealing with the John Avalanche. It's just comes tumbling out.
Well, see, I went for a run this morning, so I'm all energized.
Oh, nice. Nice. Good for you. Good for you.
Thanks. Yeah. But, you know, we recorded two episodes this week.
We did.
And I'm not sure which episode we're doing this recording for.
We can stay on the running theme and go with...
But that's what I was thinking. That's why I thought I'd bring that up.
Yeah, let's do that then.
Okay. So we had a lovely conversation with the too tall, too handsome, and too successful Pierre Lind. We hated him. He was lovely.
No.
Really nice.
He was lovely. And
yeah, he was. But you can hate somebody for being lovely.
No.
Hate's a strong word.
I was just delighted to get to know him because I see so much of his stuff on LinkedIn. So I've been actually just able to talk to him. It was really fun.
Yeah, and it was cool that he took the time out of his being a busy executive. I mean, you two had a lot in common, I felt.
Instant best friends. So what's it like being really successful? Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's really tough.
Yeah.
I like to run far. Do you like to run far?
I really couldn't join in those conversations. It's like that time.
I had a load of questions from them we just never got to. That's a sign of a good conversation. Though.
Should we do a sequel?
I think we should.
I once went to the pub with three blokes who were all about 6'2", and I didn't hear a fucking word they said all night.
Because you're short.
Yeah, and they were talking across to each other. So like, stick a jukebox.
Did you not just get them to sit down? Level the playing field?
No, we're out in Shrewsbury on a Friday night. You know, there's nowhere to sit.
Oh, okay.
But it was quite funny. We were going into this pub and they were like, look, it's a bit rough in here. I'm like, yeah. And, well, you know, just wanted to give you a bit of a warning. It's a bit of a biker's pub. I said, it'll be fine. We walk in. What do we hear? John! And, it turned out loads of people I knew drank in there. Oh, how we laughed. Spent the evening singing along to Bat Out of Hell. The album, not just the song.
Just the whole album. Let's go.
Pretty much, yeah. That does happen in biker pubs. I believe.
I introduced my son to Motorhead's Ace of Spades at the weekend.
What a tune that is.
He was very taken with it. It was great.
It's worth, for version's sake, I think that their appearance on The Young Ones is fantastic.
Okay.
It's just like seeing Lemmy do it. It's just absolutely wicked. Although I saw Lemmy with Slash and Dave Grohl doing the
Ace of Spades. That was brilliant.
That was very cool. Yeah.
That is cool. That is cool.
Very, very good. But a mate of mine had some great Lemmy stories because one of his besties was a mechanic and he specialized in very, very high end cars. And he would frequently be working through the night. And Lemmy lived by him. And Lemmy was always apparently speeding his tits off or doing something similar. And so he'd just be wandering the streets in the middle of the night and he'd just wander into his garage and sit and have a chat.
Nice. That's cool.
I can't think of anybody cooler to do that with. It's like, if I'd met Lemmy while he was alive, I would have been starstruck, I think.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. But anyway, I was a little starstruck by Pierre. So tall, so handsome.
Very. Yeah, he's a really cool guy. It was, he's got his big event at the end of the month, which he's very excited about.
Yeah, you say end of the month. I think it starts 22nd.
Well, that's pretty much the end of the month, isn't it?
Yeah, and 70% soon. Is practically all of it.
I like to round up.
Who are you, fucking Betting and Gaming Council?
Way! fans.
And that relates back to a previous episode of the Gambling Fans.
Running joke.
You calling my running a joke?
Oh, I see what he did.
Yeah, see, and we get back to running.
Do you know who we also need to talk about? We need to talk about our amazing sponsors.
Yeah, that's a good shout. I wonder if they've been running.
Do you think so?
No, I don't.
No, I don't think so.
I think they're too busy putting people in the right roles.
Because they're just work. It's just, are we finding the right candidates? Are we getting the right candidates in front of the hiring manager? Are we helping people with their careers? It's all they think about.
Are we looking at this holistically, getting the right character into the right position?
Yeah. The culture fits a huge thing. Huge thing. You know, you could have a great person, just wrong culture, and it's just not going to click, right? So you want somebody who's going to help you with that.
Every Super job important. I've had.
Yeah, Maverick, you lone wolf.
Yeah. Yeah. Best job for my personality type is to not work. Oh, well.
So, Gaming Recruitment Solutions, grs-recruit.com.
That is a hyphen. Check
them out for all your recruitment needs.
Maybe I should talk to them.
Online.
Maybe they could help me.
They can do a lot, but
let's see how fucking good they are, shall we? Let's prove their test their mettle.
Operation get John a job.
I'll email them and they'll just get back and get fucked. We're not magicians.
Who this?
Yeah, who this? New phone. This is your email address, Paul. Doesn't work like that. Anyway,
I don't
GRS.
Pay you enough.
Gaming Recruitment Solutions, grs-recruit.com for all your recruitment needs within the gambling industry. Enjoy the episode. Meet Pierre. We're joined by our latest celebrity guest of the gambling industry. Fintan and I are joined by Pierre Lind, co-founder and managing director of iGaming Next. Pierre, welcome.
Well, thank you so much, John. And I don't know about celebrity. I think my team has something to say about these like ego boosts that you mentioned here in the beginning. But yeah, thank you.
I've probably just made several of your team sick in their mouths. Yes. Pierre, I'm a little surprised that you've joined us. I've got to be honest with you, because this is going to sound odd, right? But yeah, how tall are you?
It's centimeter 190. How is that relevant to me?
That's pretty tall, isn't it? That's like 6'3" or something like that.
Yeah, something along those lines, I think.
So that's 6'3", right? So you're quite tall. You're quite, you know, you're a good-looking guy. You know, you dress very, very nicely. And, you know, you. With your comedy accent, I just assumed that you were AI.
Yeah, well, you know, the AI is being refined, and it's constantly improving itself here, as we've seen in the last
couple
of
years. Oh, no, obviously you're an older iteration of AI. Yeah, you're obviously not the latest.
Well, but budget constraints and such, you know.
Oh, no, seriously. But I can't believe that iGaming Next suffers any budget constraints.
ask our accountant, Anna. She will laugh at that question, I think.
So you're co-founder of iGaming Next. It's probably a silly question, but who came up with the name iGaming Next?
Well, it sounds very straightforward, actually, but we had a long process together with Michael and Martin that we co-founded the company with, and we wrote down something like 50 or 60 different names. And I guess it's a testament maybe to the lack of creativity that all three of us possess, but iGaming Next was basically the best that we could come up with.
Wow.
It's as simple as that, actually.
So I was wondering if the, you know, IGN, I was wondering if that was like deliberate or if there was some kind of an SEO thing in the IGN, you know.
No, you know, I appreciate the overthinking here, but it's essentially the name comes down to lack of creativity and throwing names around for like 2 weeks and nothing worked. And then kind of Agami Next, it kind of sounded good. You know, we want to be a bit forward thinking, future driven and so on and so forth. That is essentially what we felt was the best at the time.
I'm going to keep this recording. And I'm going to go and play it at the seaside where my parents' ashes are scattered because nobody's ever accused me of overthinking before. Mom, Dad, we'll make you proud.
There we go.
Throw the speaker in the water.
Yeah, we start off by throwing some compliments around the head, John. Yes.
Yeah, that's weird. It does feel strange. But it's the new positive thinking Gambling Files podcast. So one of the things about iGamingNext, one of the things that we've seen a lot on the old business social media is you guys have a podcast, you present it, right?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I draw inspiration from you guys.
Well, that's very fair. Fenton, is he lying?
I'm just trying to keep this going, right? Because you told me in the beginning.
It's very polite. Yeah. I don't think he thinks about us at all, John.
I don't think he does either, which is a shame.
Of course I do. How can you not miss the Gambling File podcast if you're in the gambling industry? I think it's impossible at this stage.
I don't know. The numbers suggest otherwise. The numbers suggest quite a few people have missed us.
It's a small industry.
That's do you know what? That's good.
That's what we tell ourselves every
week. We should put that on our marketing, Fenton.
You know, you use it as your mantra, you know, in the beginning of the day when you wake up in the morning.
How's the figures, John? Well, Fenton, it's a small industry. most of the media businesses in the gambling space have been kind of forward thinking, and back in the day it would be like you just do a magazine, you just sell your display ads, that's what you do. But an awful lot of the publications have branched out into, you know, what a largely very, very well thought of, as in highly regarded events and stuff as well. And that's a big part of what you guys do as well, isn't it? So you do the Malta one, the Valletta one, yeah? What other events have you got? Because Valletta's coming up soon, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. In 2 weeks' time, at the time of this recording, on the 21st and 22nd of June, we have the Valletta event, of course. Second event that we do is New York as well, which is in March of next year. Yeah, so we host those two. Those two events are the kind of the major conferences that we do. But then we also host some probably about 10 to 12 networking events around the year as well, mostly in Malta, but also kind of across Europe and in the US as well, to keep people engaged. So that's kind of the two arms that we have in the company. So we have the event arm, so kind of half the team that we have internally are just focusing on the events, and then the other half of the team is focusing on our media, which is what you just mentioned, the podcast, news portal, so on and so forth.
What's the I know the podcast has been going for a little while. What do you find works for you on the podcast? Are there particular areas that do well? I'm just thinking how we can boost our numbers a bit, Fenton.
Yeah, exactly.
Learn, right?
So a litmus test here. What works? I think you guys have done like a similar amount of episodes as I have. I think you guys are close to 100, by the way. Do you have a plan for the 100 podcast? Sorry to like interrupt the question here, but...
Well, the only one that we really planned a celebration for was the 69th episode.
Fair enough. It's like
we should probably plan something for the 138th.
Right, that's the next one.
That's 2 times 69, Fenton.
Right.
I'm not a maths guy.
What's 138?
I was thinking of the classic Misfits song. Of course, we are 138.
Yeah. So I would say, okay, so what works in the podcast? I would say, you know, generally, just be yourself in the podcast and do what you like. John, in your case, maybe you should approach the opposite. But in our case, what works for us is, you know, I kind of bring on guests that I kind of interested in personally, and mm-hmm. I do topics that I like myself. So more than trying to think about the audience, I'm being a bit selfish, let's say, in my pursuit in the podcast. And I'm just doing kind of episodes that interest me. And throughout the years, like, my interests change, you know. So 2 years ago, the type of episodes I did were very different from the episodes that I do today. You know, we're getting a little bit older and hopefully it's slightly wiser along the years. Not guaranteed, though. And in a couple of years' time, I'm sure that the episode will be very different than what they are now. But I think that's just the general guiding principle, that at the end of the day, these recordings should be fun, you know. And if they are not fun, if they become like a drag, then it's a lot harder to be consistent in the creation of the episodes. Yeah. I think. I don't know if that's something you can relate to.
Going wrong, you know. we haven't made it fun. We've been for too anybody. Corporate.
Yeah,
that's it. Too corporate.
Too corporate.
Too corporate.
Nailed it.
I get that feeling too. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a similar way that we've approached, isn't it? What do we want to learn about? What are we interested in? Yeah. Who seems nice?
Exactly. And it can be hard as well, because, you know, sometimes people, once the microphone goes on, they kind of change a little bit, so they kind of freeze up a little bit and things like this as well. So there's a little bit of trial and error sometimes as well with the.
Exactly. This industry is not exactly known for including people that are like incredibly like out there with information, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Information, right? So it's not always the easiest to find people who are able to speak their mind as they see fit.
For many different reasons.
For many reasons, yes.
So how did the journey start? Because if I remember correctly, you've done the what I call the classic young man into the gambling industry arc, which is you started off with poker and then kind of just rolled that up into a gambling industry career. So talk to me a little bit about the poker stuff you did in the early days. What that looked like.
All right, I'll tell you the origin story. I mean, first of all, you know, we have to go back to like early teenage years, like 12, 13 years old. And I apologize for like the responsible gambling fanatics in this, but we loved playing poker when we were like teenagers in school and stuff. And we would play all the time. That led eventually to me starting a poker club in Sweden at the age of 17. The tender age of 17 there, and it grew to become one of the biggest poker clubs in Sweden at that time. This was, you know, heavily during the poker boom. There was a poker club in every little village in Sweden at that time. Obviously, they were, let's say, legally questionable, the poker clubs at that time. But there was kind of like there was like a little loophole in the law, let's say, that if you are, I don't know how to translate it in English, but if it's like if you're a group of friends, you can play poker for money
if it's a social club kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly, but it has to be defined as a group of friends. Now this definition in the law is very loose, and there wasn't really any precedents on that front. Like, can a group of friends be 10 people? Can it be 100 people? It wasn't really clear at that time. So I think at that time, a lot of these poker clubs, they were able to kind of operate based on this little loophole, let's say. And we were one of them. We operated that poker club for a couple of years and traveled around the poker tour. You know, I was heavily involved in the Swedish poker scene at that time. So I was in the Swedish Poker Federation during that time as well. We organized the Swedish Poker Championships. We were like lobbying for the politicians to legalize poker in Sweden. Which actually wasn't successful. But actually, it's something we haven't mentioned before, but and people don't remember this or even from that time, but there was like a month in Sweden where playing poker and organizing poker was legal. Did you know that?
No.
For like a month it was legal, okay? Because there was one of the poker clubs, the police came and they did a police razzia, and this went to court. And in the lowest instance of court, poker was classified as a skill game.
Wow.
And so when this court case came out, organizing poker, you know, charging rake, you can do anything without the license, anything. It was completely legal according to this statement. But then a month later, there was another court case that went up in the second instance, which then defined poker as a game of luck again. And then unfortunately, these like big wild dreams that we had at that time were all crushed. I remember I went to like the hotel, like the biggest hotel in the city I lived. I went to them and I'm like, poker is legal. We want to organize the biggest Swedish tournament that ever has been organized in Sweden. This was like 2007, I think. And we were about to organize a tournament for like 1,000 people there, but then dreams were crushed, unfortunately, and we couldn't do it. But there was actually other tournaments that hosted. I remember like the biggest one was in Gebbestad in Sweden. It was like also a big thing. It was like 800 people that played poker, completely illegal. They had like radio ads, you know, it was a wild time back then, you know, and that ended up becoming a big court case in Sweden. And then after that, a lot of these poker clubs, they kind of disappeared and dwindled a bit. But yeah, that's
where are you from in Sweden?
So I'm just outside of Gothenburg, the second biggest city in Sweden, on the west coast. That's where the nice people live.
But big news today for all Swedes, I would think.
Oh yeah, that you're referring to Zlatan, I suppose.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, you never know what it could be behind this. Yeah, big news actually. Our head of marketing is a bit sentimental today, Nico. He organized marketing campaigns for Zlatan for two different companies in two different eras. Actually, back in the day, for Betthard, they did a campaign for Zlatan and another company. Yeah. I don't know. I heard someone say that it's actually not Zlatan retiring from football. It's football retiring from Zlatan.
That's too perfect. That's absolutely wonderful. I'm a huge fan of Ibrahimovic, and I think he's been really misrepresented.
So is Zlatan, by the way.
Yeah, but do you know what I mean? Why shouldn't he be? The guy's extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. He's a wonderful footballer. He's got unique vision, incredibly skillful. He played the professional game at the very top level until the age of 41. Do you know what I mean?
I mean,
guy's extraordinary.
Yeah, he was amazing. And he never won, like, he never won the Champions League. He never got far in, like, the Nationals, in, like, the World Cup or Euro Cup or whatever. But still, he's regarded as one of the best players ever, right? And definitely one of the most charismatic players in the world, for sure.
No question. So I read, I definitely read his first autobiography. I'm not sure if I read the second one. But I read the first one, which I think was I Am Zlatan. And like, I remember reading it and thinking, you know, the way that the press treat him, the way that people speak about him, he's like, he's taking the piss nonstop. He's joking with us, and he's doing it deadpan. That's, and people are taking him seriously. The guy is almost constantly joking, in my opinion. I think he's just got a super dry, super deadpan sense of humor. He is very, very funny once you've realized that. Yeah. But he's like, he's having a laugh.
And did you see, like, when did you see when he started playing for Los Angeles and Kobe Bryant sent him a shirt, right? And Zlatan signed it and sent it back to Kobe.
If I could just have like 10% of that confidence, it'd be right. Amazing, right? Just a little bit.
But yeah, he's glorious, and he's also, I think, and we're going to get into sports in a second. He's also a great example of kind of two things. One is, now I've interviewed a lot of athletes over the years, right? And mostly they are fucking boring. And I'm being polite when I say fucking boring, right? The ones that aren't fucking boring are the ones that have generally become professional athletes later in life, who've had a life, who knows what it means, who know what it means to pay rent and to do things that aren't just training. Like, have you ever seen Michael Phelps being interviewed? Jesus, fuck, that man's boring. Tell me, how was your week? Well, I swam.
Oh. Yeah. You know, even no apologized for smoking weed.
No wonder he did. My God, his brain must have been crying out for some stimulants. But yeah, those guys are really, really interesting. But it also, it makes athletes more resilient and stronger when they don't just stick to one sport. And Zlatan's actually a wonderful example of that, because he's been a lifelong, I think, practitioner of Taekwondo. And like, you see the guy, where some of the fouls that he's committed, I don't think would be possible without the Taekwondo. Look this up on YouTube. There is a foul that he commits on John Terry of Chelsea, a self-proclaimed tough guy, and he drops Terry with the most perfect elbow I've ever seen in my life on a football pitch. It's absolutely fabulous. But it's, you know, to be playing at the very top level at 41 years old, and to actually not have had a huge amount of, he hasn't had a lot of injury problems until the last couple of years. You know, his physical resilience is extraordinary. And that's the other thing. So, like, you look at ultra runners, and the example that I always cite is, two. Dean Karnazes, who's his big passion outside of running is windsurfing. And you look at the guy compared to most ultra runners, he's made of bricks. I mean, he's rock solid. Yeah. And it's that core of his is just absolutely absurd. And that's from the windsurfing. And he's another guy. He's never had any major injury problems. This physical resilience from doing shit that has you going lots of different directions. The guys that are just running and going forwards and backwards all the time get all sorts of injury problems. It's varying the movements and doing all that shit. Those are the resilient, robust people. Anyway, so I'm going to shut up for a bit.
Yeah, but there's another example here. I don't know if Finta knows this as well. David Goggins, speaking of long distance runners, like, there you can talk about the guy who has resilience. He was a Navy SEAL, right? That's what his claim to fame at the beginning. He was this like 300-pound guy, and just one day he decided, I want to be in the Navy SEAL. He lost like 150 pounds or something, managed to get himself into the Navy SEALs, completed the training. And then there was someone who died within Navy SEALs, and he wanted to raise funds for this person and for his family. So naturally what he did is he Googled, what is the hardest race in the world? Not being a runner. Okay. And the answer was Badwater, right? Which is this crazy ultra race across the Nevada Death Valley, right in the middle of summer. And so he emailed the organizer, and he's like, can I enter this race? And the organizer, called back, like, you can't just enter this race without being a runner. Like, people, like, stupid people, they do that and they die. You know what I mean? And so he said to David, you can only enter this race if you're first able to prove yourself and complete a 100-mile run in under 24 hours. So that's essentially four marathons in under 24 hours. David Goggins was like 200 pounds at that time or something like this, like just under 100 kilo. And he decided to do it without any training whatsoever. He broke like all the bones in his feet during this race. And at mile 60, he shot himself. And then he collapsed.
I'm surprised it took that long.
Yeah, I mean, that's like two and a half marathons right there. Eventually got up, continue running, and then completed the race. Now that's a story of resilience if I ever saw one. So I was reading that story, and I was like doing like shorter runs, and like I was coming up with excuses for myself, like, oh, I'm so busy. I'm like the managing director of this company, and I don't have the time, I don't have the effort. And then you read David Goggins' stories and you're like, okay, there is a little bit more to give here.
there's actually, just to build on that, there's a book called Living with a SEAL, and it's written by an American guy called Jesse Eitzler.
Oh my god, he's hilarious, that guy. Yes, actually.
So funny. The seal is David Goggins.
Yeah.
And he actually met David at that race, that 100-mile race. So it's even better. David shows up. So like him, Jesse and his mates, they show, because it's a running track. So you basically just, how many laps can you do in 24 hours is the race. So they show up with like full kit, sleeping beds, masseuse, food, everything. Goggins was sitting there in a fold-out chair and he had a box of crackers and a bottle of water, and that was it. And it's just the story just kind of goes just of like, just how angry this man looked just running around this track, because he hates running is his whole thing as well.
And that race was like, it was a team race, right?
Yeah.
So people run in fours and then they take turns to complete the 100 race. And David came alone.
And just did it. And then he hit the 100 miles and he stopped. And when he rang up the Badwater guys again, they go, oh, how far did you go in 24 hours? And he goes, oh, I didn't even realize. I just stopped at 100 miles. Yeah. And so, like, just you're completely unprepared for everything that came. But just he's a super cool guy.
A little qualifier about Badwater. Two interesting things about Badwater. The first one is nobody's died while doing it, if I remember correctly.
Which is insane when you think about it.
It's bonkers. And that race scares the living piss out of me. But I think one of the most interesting things about it, although it's slightly different now, is that you run across Death Valley in the middle of July, and then you go up the side of Mount Whitney, which is the largest mountain in the contiguous United States. And it used to go to the top, but it doesn't go to the top anymore because it's protected at the top. But you still go, you know, three quarters of the way to the top of the largest mountain in the contiguous US.
Yeah.
It's pretty badass race.
We have actually, in the gaming industry, we have a couple of examples of people who have done these like crazy feats as well. I spoke to Angus Nisbet of BetMGM. He's like the guy who's in charge of the online gambling department of BetMGM. He did Marathon des Sables. I don't know how to pronounce it. Man, the Sables, yep. Whatever. That's also, they brand themselves as the hardest foot race in the world as well. Then you run across the Sahara Desert. He did that, right?
I did it last year.
Oh, you did it as well?
Yeah, I did it.
Oh my god! Like, how?
And you survived? And you didn't tell us about it?
It's really well organized. Is the best way to. So wow. What's good about it is the way I explain it is it's a choose your own adventure. So they've got really generous cutoff times. So there's people who just hike it. So if you've got a good hiking pace, you can absolutely walk it. And then there's the guys at the front who are like gazelles who just sprint across the desert and you don't see them after like 5 minutes. So there's with a lot of ultra marathons, there's really strict cutoff times, where with this one, it's actually really generous. It's really well marked. There's aid stations like every 10K. I'd never felt safer in a race doing this one. It was tough, but it's very doable,
right? And so that's basically that's also like four or five marathons, and you have
so five days
to do it or something.
Yeah, it's 250k ish. So it's like
more.
So you do like 30k, 35k, 25k in the first 3 days, and then it's the long day, so you get 2 days to complete about 90k. And then you finish with a marathon. Then there's a marathon the day after that. And then it's like a 5K walk to the bus kind of thing.
Okay, I have a question for you. Did you cry at the end?
I did. So I read all the books leading up to that. And everybody who's written the book about the race talked about crying at the end. And you're reading the book going, it's fucking ridiculous. That's just stupid. Like, what the fuck would you cry, right? Just... go pack your shit and go home kind of thing. And I got to the end and I think I was just so emotionally done, because I was also, because you got to carry everything. So in hindsight, a lot of it was just like a massive calorie deficit. So you've got to carry all your food for the week. So I had about 3,500 calories a day. Like in normal day sitting in the office, I eat 3,000 calories. Like, so I was just on a massive calorie deficit, but yeah, I bawled, just big fucking tears.
I would have as well. I'd have got to the end and I'd been crying like, how much did I pay for this? Fuck.
There's that too. There's the entry cost, and then it's all the lightweight kit because you've got to carry everything. So it's like, right, I need the 20 gram sleeping bag and the titanium spoon.
I've got to find a lighter spoon.
The carbon fiber cigarette lighter or whatever the fuck it's going to be.
Presumably.
No, you just get the dust in it and just go. It's
fine. What? With your flowing mane?
It just makes me look faster when it flows in the wind behind me.
Oh, that's a good call.
So, Pugh, go on.
Did you have any funny stories from that race? Like any interesting or strange encounters?
Did you shit your pants?
That's what I'm asking. Yes, that was the underlying question.
There was nothing really like that. It was quite straightforward from that perspective. And I don't know if it was like because I was in the scouts as a kid or something. I found it actually quite organizing myself quite easy during the day because it's basically just camping, right? You're camping, you're doing a big hike to the next camp zone, right? There was on the long day, so this is like day four, so it's the, I don't know, it was like 86K or something that day. And I'd struggle to eat calories. So as the, basically I'm Irish, so I'm built for winter, right? I'm built for rain and wind and all that kind of stuff. I'm not built for sunshine. So as the day got hotter, I just get slower and slower and slower. And then as the day gets cooler, I get faster and faster. So it's kind of, you can literally plot my times with the temperature. But I couldn't, one of the mistakes I made was all my calories were solid. So I didn't bring enough liquid calories. So I just couldn't, I could drink water, but I couldn't eat. So I just, as I got hotter, I just couldn't eat anything. So by sunset, I was just empty, is the only way to describe it. So like cycling, they call it bonking, where you just run out of glucose. So I was just
empty. You run into the wall. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sitting there, I got to an aid station and they had like little deck chairs and stuff. I'm sitting in deck chairs. And one of the things you got to do is you got to put a glow stick on your bag for the night. So basically, if you fall over, they can fucking find you. And I'm sitting there and I'm trying to break the glow stick. And I can't break the glow stick. Now, it's been a long time since I've had to interact with glow sticks. I'm like, oh, maybe glow stick technology's changed. Maybe I shake it. And like, no, fucking nothing. So I'm sitting there trying to read the instruction manual of like the glow stick. And then I realize, oh, it is just break it. And I don't have the strength to break the glow stick. So that was kind of my lowest. So I just kind of, all right, let's just take off my shoes and socks and let's just rest for a bit. And I just ate a load of food and had a sleep. And so I had like a nap for a couple of hours. And then the calories had kicked in and I broke the glow stick and I went on again. That was probably the worst moment of just being low. But actually, it was also because the way it works is you finish the marathon and you get your medal and you're basically finished. But if you, on the very, very last bit, if you don't walk like the 5K to the buses, you are considered you did not finish. You DNF. And I think I was just done. So I was just physically, like the worst I actually felt and looked was on the very last 5K walk to the bus. And the guys in the tent beside me were like, Fintan, this is the worst we've ever seen you. And I was like, well, I've got my medal. I'm done. Give me a fucking dune buggy out of here. Let's go. But so that was actually the worst bit. Physically, I think, as well. But yeah, it's very doable. It's a very, it's a very runnable race. Like if you're I'm not a good runner. If you're a good runner, it's super runnable.
It's just through the Sahara desert.
Yeah, but it's mostly rocks. It sounds like, because we've all got this like Lawrence of Arabia type Hollywood TV notion. So there is definitely sand dunes. There's big sand dunes. There's little sand dunes. There's rolling sand dunes. But there's also just like what feels like tarmac of just hard rock, like hard packed sand with like rock fields is the best way to describe it. So there's just tons of just runnable, super runnable sections as well. So it's just a complete mix of terrain. And then the mountains, like there's a couple of big jebels and stuff you got to go up every day. But like after an hour of hiking, you're at the top. So it's not like it's 6 hours of hiking up a mountain. It's like it's an hour of hiking and then you run along a ridge and then you coming down to sand's super fun. You feel like a badass and like there's some great, always some great, like photographers are always there. So you just look like a beast coming down the sand.
And like Fintan, in general, like in your daily life, like if you go out running today, like what in your general shape, like how, what type of distances do you do, or like how far do you run, and what shape are you in? Like,
so I, to be honest with you, I lost all interest in. So I recovered really quickly. Oh yeah, I was doing ultras and stuff before this, so that was like it wasn't like my first whatever. So I lost all interest in running after this. Because mentally I was, physically I was fine. Mentally I was just done. Just like, I've hit it. But I'm back into the groove now. I'll 90 minute runs, like an easy morning before breakfast. Like I can't do it right now, but pre MDS, I could easily go for a run a marathon before breakfast.
All right.
That will be, now don't get me wrong, it'll be a slow marathon. Like I'm not fat, like it's a 4-hour marathon type stuff. It's not fast running, but I could just go do that.
It's insulting say that so casually. To hear you say that. Like that's really exactly. Slow.
So casually. Yeah. So casually. What? Yeah. But marathon before breakfast. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, it's not that. It's that he's saying 4 hours is slow. Fuck him.
And stuff like that. So I'm a diesel engine is the way I describe it. So I'll never be the fastest guy in the race, but I can just chug along forever.
Yeah, but you're a faster diesel engine than me.
Diesel. I'm training now for 100K in Sweden, actually in Sweden, in November. Oh, yeah. So the weekend of my birthday.
Okay. It's, happy birthday. That's a hell of a birthday present.
Oh, it's proper demon stuff. And I need to figure it's I'll get the name, but it's a qualifier. My goal is to go do UTMB. So Ultra Trail Mont Blanc in Chamonix. So it's up and over Mont Blanc and all that kind of stuff. So to get it, you need to qualify. You need to get, they call it stones now is the new system. So I found this race in Sweden on the weekend of my birthday. I'm like, oh, well, that's just perfect. That's what we need to do.
It's just so a gift.
So it's 100K on the Swedish coast. So I'm assuming it's going to be like wind and rain and cold and miserable. So start at midnight kind of thing. It's brilliant.
Pierre, you did an ultra the other week, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I did my first ultra marathon.
Congratulations. Right?
That was it. And, it sounds so badass, like ultra marathon. But actually, it was just like 10% further than a marathon. But still, it goes in the ultra category, right? It doesn't matter.
The terrain's always harder, though. So it's rarely an ultra on the road. It's usually trail running and up and over a mountain and go do something, right?
But I like that fact, an ultra marathon can be, 50K or it can be 300K, but cool, I'm an ultra marathon runner. but I did Gozo Round, right? So it's a sister island to Malta. It is a quite tough one. It's like 2,000 meter elevation. It's a tough one because I had no idea how to pace myself because I've never... I did marathons before on the street, but... Not on trail and not with those kind of inclines that they have there. And the trail is just a different form of running because you're just aware every step, you're aware where you're gonna step. You know, if there's a big rock or is something strange, and it's always like twists and turns left and right. So it's like full. I think what you mentioned, Fintan, maybe it's just full on mental focus for the entire duration of the race. And in my case, it took like 7.5 hours. And there was like a little tear at the end as well, even though with the shorter distance. Hence why I asked you, after 5 days of running, I can just imagine myself like totally just falling apart mentally as well. But it's a very cool race, Fintan. If you ever find yourself in Malta in May, then I'll be more than happy to invite you to the run as well.
There's one by, absolutely. I'll definitely take you up on that. There's one organized by a UK company called Rat Race. And they do one where you run on one of the islands and then you can either swim or kayak to the main island and then you run again. And I think it's in like September time or something like that.
Really? It's never heard of that. It's called the Rat Race? Because they do a lot of swim runs in Malta. There's like Ötila and those kind of races. There's a lot of stuff happening, but I never heard about the rat race actually.
It's the name of the Rat Race Adventures is the name of the organizer. They do a load of really cool stuff, particularly in the UK.
Yeah.
I'll look it up the details. But yeah, they do one in Malta. I'm like, and every year I'm like, oh, I should really just sort myself out and do that one.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to do the swim, but I could definitely kayak between the islands.
Yeah, I'm not a strong swimmer either. But I realized, speaking of that race, I realized how it would feel when I'm 85 years old. Because the next day, I didn't realize that I had booked my flights to SBC New York, or New Jersey. And I didn't realize the flights were the next day. Not being used to like those type of distances or whatever. I woke up the following day, totally destroyed, whatever. I went to the airport and I sat on this plane. I fell asleep on the plane, and then kind of 4 hours later, I needed to go to the bathroom. And you know how they say when you go on a long haul flight that don't forget to stretch and like stretch out and like loosen up your muscles, whatever. And then you never do it because, why would you or whatever? But then I realized, okay, this is how I will feel when I'm 85 years old, because I got stuck in this seating position. And I tried to go to the bathroom in like trying to walk, like imagine like a sed trying to walk through the aisle. I can't straighten my leg, can't straighten my back all the way there. And then I realized, okay, this is why you get the advice to move around and walk. It's not exactly targeted to our demographic, advice, but this is how you will feel when you're 85.
I had one, I'd blown out my, it was a Snowdonia race. I'd blown out my quads so much, to step off a curb, I had to go backwards.
Why do you put yourself through this?
Well, look, it's clearly I've got demons. Like that's obvious. No, I think it's like everything, particularly everything I do, is so digital and unreal. You know, I move clicks about. I buy and sell clicks, ultimately, right? That's my job. So it's all just like stuff on a screen. So my life is so, I'm sitting in an air-conditioned office on a comfy chair, and I'm buying and selling clicks, and, I'll 10-minute cycle home, and I have dinner with my, like, there's no struggle. There's nothing physical. And I think that's really bad. I think you need something real, and you need to feel, I don't know, you just need the whatever exercise gives you or whatever, just to, I did like a lactate threshold test yesterday and I nearly got sick afterwards.
Yeah.
That's the closest I get to discomfort. And it's, it's a privilege that my life's so easy. I can invent the hardships.
But like as animals, we are designed for struggle. We're designed for hardship. Yeah. We're designed to endure. And that's what we're not doing. We're not designed to fucking sit at a desk.
Yeah, exactly.
Hence, I am talking to you using a standing desk adapter because it's absolutely killing me. I just started running again a couple of weeks ago. And, it's been a long time coming. I used to run a lot. I've never done an ultra because my health and my fatness combined to stop me from doing that, and having young children as well. If you think about the way that the human body works, we are designed to store fat. We're designed for hardship. Isn't any anymore.
So someone told me the other day life is not about finding balance. Like all these self-help gurus, they're like, you need balance in your life. And it's like, no, you don't need balance. You need contrast. So you need the one side, which is like, the organized, structured, kind of relaxed side. It's like the white side, let's say. And then you need this like chaos side as well, which is like totally, hardcore mode or whatever. Kind of like the yin and the yang, so to say, in life. And instead of balance, you find this contrast, try to find that in life instead. And kind of like everything, I think I can relate to that a bit, like me and people in my family, we are like extreme personalities. So it's either, you know, far left or far right, like not politically, by the way, but my brother, for example, he's a classic bodybuilder. He's he and like talk about like contrast in life, because one part of the year he would bulk and he just eat as much as he can and to try to grow as much as possible for competition. And then the other part of the year, he would diet, and it's this extreme diet. You know, they go down to 2.5% body fat. When they go on stage, they are so dry that if you hold the skin like this, if you pinch yourself and you let the skin go, the skin stays because there is no water in the tissue. That's how they dehydrate it. They go when they go on stage. So they are like essentially the body is dying. You know, they say something like, if the body is under 5% body fat, it can't sustain itself for a longer period of time, right? So they are literally on their way to death.
That's a tightrope I walk every day.
I can't relate to that. Extreme, yes, I like it. But then the funniest part of this is, you know, they go on stage, and my brother is one of the best classic bodybuilders in Scandinavia, and he go on stage. Maybe he wins the competition, maybe he doesn't. But if he wins, congratulations, here's a medal, 2 kilo of protein powder, and off you go. And that's all the recognition they get. It's not a big sport, there's not that many followers, there's no money, there's no recognition, there's nothing, right? And so back to this question, like, why do you put yourself through this? And as you point out, Fintan, I think as well, it is this kind of primal feeling that we, at the end of the day, you know, we feel alive when we're at the edge. I think this is like the hunter-gatherer kind of mentality, right? This is where we come from.
Well, you appreciate the good stuff even more.
Yes, right? That too.
So
yes.
You just like, you get, you know, once you, you know, you've, I don't know, you've worked out, you've had a shower, you're eating a nice, your breakfast or whatever it is, and it's like, oh, this is it's even tasty, everything's nicer.
Yes, yeah, exactly. That definitely, my brother afterwards, he goes to like McDonald's or whatever and he buys like 7 Big Macs. I can tell you, like, he definitely appreciates those Big Macs more than we would. he brings with him, that's his tradition, he brings like a 2 kilo jar of Nutella.
Nice, with a big spoon and just
with a big spoon, yeah, with the nice. titanium spoon, yes, and then he eats everything. You gotta save on the weight,
of course. I love it. So, what's your next race? What have you got lined up?
I'm looking now. I want to get inspired. Maybe you have some ideas, Fintan, because I have never ran a race outside of Malta. I've done like 100 races here in Malta, but I've never did one abroad actually. And I think that's the next step for me. Is I would love to do 100K.
I got to throw this out there. I think a lot of the big races are massively oversubscribed, and I think there are a lot of really excellent, really, really challenging, smaller, more local races out there. Like, there's two ultras near me, and they couldn't be more different. And it's about the time of year and the route, and, you know, it's like, If I were in ultra shape, which I'm quite clearly not, because my body fat's just too low to sustain an ultra, I you know what I mean, because the numbers have just absolutely exploded in the bigger races. That I'd be looking at something just small and interesting. Like, if I were looking in the UK, I'd maybe look at the Hadrian's Wall one, which I think is 85 miles, because you've got a nice bit of history as well. There's one near me which I would actually really love to do, which is the Shropshire, I think it's called the Shropshire Way. It's not actually on the Shropshire Way, but it is part of the Shropshire Way. The county's called Shropshire, and it goes over all of the big hills in the county except for two. And it's like fucking shark's teeth in parts, but it's absolutely stunning. The food is incredible, and it's a small local event. It's 85 miles. I would look for something like that, if I was honest with you, something that's quirky and different.
I think it's got to speak to you, because the thing about it is, particularly for like anything above 50K, even the 50K ones, like with the elevation and stuff as well, the training's going to suck, right? So it has to be a race you're interested in, and it has to kind of like catch your, for me, well, I'm talking about me, it has to catch my like motivation of like, okay, I can get behind that. And there's so many different formats as well. So like there's ones where it's just, it's a running track and you have 12 hours or 24 hours. And it's just how many loops can you do in 24 hours, right? Like the David Goggins one, right?
Yep.
There's another one called the Backyard Ultra, which is insane. So what that is, it's a 7.6K loop or something like that. It's basically a 7K loop, give or take. You have 1 hour to complete the loop, okay? And then the race starts again on the next hour.
Every hour, right? Oh, okay.
And it only stops when there's no more runners. So it's a last person standing.
Oh my God. That's brutal.
There's a woman's just done like 4 days or something crazy, like three. So basically, and the way it's timed out is like, you'll end up doing 100 miles. So 160K in 24 hours is kind of what it works out of. So like there's people running for like 3 days.
Jesus Christ. I think stay away from those races with them.
Oh, I've tried it. They're tough. Or it could be like, right, there's, I don't know, Mont Blanc and it's, you're in the mountains, or there's stuff in like, you've got to find one where you're like, oh wow, that's really inspiring.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just banking on, Apple, it's supposed to release the new VR mixed reality glasses today. I'm just banking on the fact that there's going to be like a running feature in those, and I can go to Mont Blanc and like run in the metaverse without training.
Pair that with a treadmill and off you go, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I sweat too much for those kind of things. I've got to be really careful with headphones. I have to use the
Aftershocks.
The Aftershocks, because they're basically waterproof.
Oh, yeah.
And I would burn, like I've burned through AirPods, Beats, wired headphones, you name it. I'm a sweater.
I've just been looking up the those are UK Ultra that I don't think it's been put on post COVID, but it was a really interesting idea because I knew the dude that thought it up. This guy called James Adams, and it was called the Piece of String. And it basically, you would meet at the start, but you don't know how long it is, and you don't know the route.
Oh, I heard about this one. There's another one where you have to escape. So the trick is you have to stay. So there's a starting point, and then you can pick any direction you want. And then you have to be, everyone's got a GPS tracker, and you have to be beyond a certain point distance-wise in a straight line every X hours. Otherwise, you're caught.
I've heard of that.
There's a UK crowd who specialize in these really extreme. They also do it's the same crowd who do the tunnel. So it's in the UK, and there's the UK's longest bicycle tunnel, and it's basically pitch dark, right? So there's no light, and you run back and forth in the tunnel for 100 miles. So there's like just pure, like it's just you and your head torch. Back and forth in this tunnel.
That would be an absolute head fuck. There's a story on the BBC about that one a little while ago on the BBC Sport website.
There's a really good documentary on YouTube.
have you seen the Barclays Marathon?
Yes.
That's a really funny. Yes. That's a hilarious as well, right? The guy, the race organizer, he has this really twisted sense of humor, and he just fucks with people, basically. He just fucks with the runners.
The thing, if you look at the caliber of runners that attempt Barclays Marathons,
they fail. It's like the creme de la creme.
And hardly anybody finishes it ever. Yeah. Like, how hard must that be?
It's super hard. It's
I like
it's,
that.
It's incomprehensible, isn't it? Pretty much.
He invented the backyard. So that backyard ultra race, he invented that. And it's literally his back garden. it's spawned into this like big international thing.
I like that in the Barclays marathons, you know, it's like incredibly difficult race, not just the run, but you also have to be very good at orienting yourself, right? In that race, there's like, you can't use your GPS, and it's like in the wilderness, and you have to find the checkpoints, and it's an invitational, right? So you have to apply, and you have to get invited to this like incredibly difficult race. And then every year he brings in one person who is like the least qualified of all the applicants, that he just brings that person in. And it's always like some like military guy or whatever who's like, oh yeah, you know, you're like, I've been in the military for, you know, 20 years, I can do anything. And then they come there and they, you know, within the hour they give up. You know, they just realize, they just go in the woods, so they realize like, okay, I have like nothing here to do.
It's stuff's really, yeah, it's a really interesting one, because it's like, it's as much about the psychology of it as it is about the physicality of it, because it's just randomness. And I think that's the thing, like, if you're doing any of these races, something will go wrong.
Yeah,
so are you ready for it to go wrong? My favorite one was called a dice race. So there was six different courses. We were given GPS files for six different courses, and it was like 2 kilometers, 4 kilometers, six, basically a dice. So it was up to like 12 to 24K. No, sorry, 6, 12. Yeah, anyway, it was all the different distances. And they would roll a dice every loop, and then you'd know which course you got. And then they just time capped it of, we'll be done in like 18 hours. So the way it ended up, we ended up with like 45 minutes left to go, and they're about to roll the dice. Now, it could be like, we're just going to do like a 2K quick loop, or we're gone for the next 24K or whatever it's going to be. And just the complete uncertainty of what was about to happen was really, really interesting. And you could see people just breaking, because they've been running like all day, and people are just like, oh no, I just can't deal with it. Like, because we're in a bar and there's like people pulling pints and there's food cooking and the fire's warm. And so it was just so easy to just stop and have a beer and have a burger and just fucking chill out. Or are you going to be stupid enough? You're like, right, let's fucking go. It doesn't matter what comes up, we're going. And what was amazing was the people who were still in it, we got like a really low number. And everybody was really disappointed. Like, just the guy like, oh no, let's go again. But that kind of uncertainty in dealing with like adversity in inverted commas, yep, is a really cool, that's what I enjoy.
Well, that brings me on to a very interesting question. Now, of the three of us, I'm the only one that hasn't done an ultra marathon. And I think that if we looked at our professional achievements as well, we're talking about a co-founder and managing director of a successful gambling media company, and the chairman and co-founder of a successful affiliate. Now, are there lessons from your sporting achievements that you have been able to apply professionally? Is there something in there about resilience and adaptability that you've taken from training and competing in races?
I always say, you know, kind of like I speak a lot to and so do you guys as well, to kind of founders of businesses and entrepreneurs, and you know, what is there like a red thread of people who choose to become an entrepreneur or like start their own business? And I think the actual first point of these like red threads is you have to be a little bit crazy, I think, to start a business, because you have to be delusional not to see the challenge that is ahead of you. And similarly, I suppose, in the races as well, like when you sign up to a, you know, ultra marathon, or you do something very difficult, in that moment, I think you have to be a little bit delusional to take on a challenge like that. And that's a bit of a red thread, I think. I mean, and then in general, of course, you know, going through like building a company is 95% of like eating shit, and like how much shit can you fit, and the more you can fit, the better you do, kind of thing. And 5% is just is the enjoyment, but most of the time it is a grind, right, to build a business. It's not exactly fun or relaxing, or, you know, you gamble your life and your future on this. And you're gonna take a pay cut to be an entrepreneur, I think there is a lot of synergies between the two. Definitely, I don't know what you think from them.
I completely agree. It's you've got to be massively over optimistic. Is the way I look at it. And there's definitely, like, from a business perspective, there's definitely been times like, what was the Mike Tyson? Everyone's got a plan until Mike Tyson punches you in the face. Whatever the quote was, that, right?
That's almost the quote, yeah.
Yeah, cause something like that, right? I'm sure he's
everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the face.
Yeah, but it was a question to Mike Tyson. Right? Oh, everyone's got a plan until I punch them in the face. And I think that's what makes an entrepreneur, right? It's just that optimism to start that fire or start that whatever. And then, like you said, I completely agree, Pierre. It is that consistency over time. Showing up every day, doing something every day, moving it forward every day is it's the boring answer, right? This isn't the answer that sells the tickets to the get rich quick scheme or the book or the app or whatever the fuck it is. It's just like show up and do the work is the actual answer. Yeah. And then if you apply that to training for an ultramarathon, it's basically, you can't just like show up and fake 100 miles if you haven't done the training. Like maybe you're the genetic freak that could, but the 99% of the population, they haven't done the training, the long, boring 5-hour runs on a Saturday morning before they take the kids to swimming or whatever it's going to be, then it's just not going to happen on race day. So yeah, just consistency over time, John.
And I think as well, like there is no end, like the point is not the finish line, like it's the journey itself that is the reward. And in a really fucked up way, you know, when you do these races, it's hard, but it's also enjoyable in some like really strange fucked up way. And similar to running a business, it's not about this like day when you will make an exit and sail into the sunset and now everything is over, because that just means that you have finished one race and now you enter another. You know, it's like when you study, like imagine people, they study for 5, 6, 7 years for a PhD or whatever, and they go through this like incredibly gritty period and little sleep and whatever. And then they get to that point where like, I have my diploma. Then the next week, you know, they celebrate, and then the next week they start working at McDonald's. Okay. Welcome to reality, motherfucker. Like now the next race starts. Right, it's not about the finish line. Like it is about the consistency, and it will never end. Like it far as long as we live, this like this journey will always be there. Steve Jobs, he said, you know, the journey is the reward, and that's what it has to be. The same with the races as well. It's not about, oh, now it's like 19 kilometers left, or now it's like 8 kilometers left. It's like no, it's here and now, and like how do you feel now, and how do you manage with what you feel in this very moment.
Yeah, I agree. Completely agree.
That's me told.
But John, the question back to you, Dennis. Is there a way here to get you on board on the ultra trail? I mean, you know, give it a year or something, and come over to Malta, and we'll run the race together.
I've only just restarted. I'm still doing the run walk period, like 40 minutes run walk. Feel pretty good. But there are a couple of sort of chronic health things that might stop me from taking it further. And I'm just way through that. As the doctor says, use pain as your guide. Great. Thanks.
Thank you. But everything hurts all the time.
That's really fucking helpful. I've done stacks and stacks of strength work. I've like, my legs are in great shape and all of that shit. But if my body says I can't, then it's just tough shit. So I've got 4 goals, which are, you know, but I don't know, potentially unrealistic. I really don't know. I am a classic plodder, and I can quite literally do it all day. But I've never done a sub 2-hour half marathon. I've never gotten close to a sub 4 marathon. I've never completed a half iron. And I've never even entered a full iron. Now, Ironman races, the cutoffs, I think, are very, very generous. So that's actually just a question of, can I do the training?
Hmm.
That's the only thing that worries me.
Surviving the training of the Ironman.
No, I think, and races when they're that big, it's almost a mathematical problem. It's, you know, what do I need to do to not die? Like, how much energy do I need? How much is my body going to make? What do I need to do to top it up? Right.
Okay.
So that's partly why I started doing this carnivore thing. Cause I was looking at I was looking at Iron Man races, right? And I was reading about Mark Allen, who went very low carb, high fat, and, you know, won Kona four times, which is pretty extraordinary. He didn't win them all doing that, but he won some of them doing that. But I was looking at that and I was like, my weight at the time, I was probably about 250 pounds, something like that. I was pretty heavy. But for my weight on the bike, so the bike leg is 112 miles in a full iron, right? So 112 miles, it's not a short distance. Yeah. You can't really fake it. You're fighting the course. The one I want to do is Ironman Wales, and it's a shark's tooth route, you know? It's tough. So I was looking at that, and I was doing the maths, and it turns out I would have to have, I think it was 7 carbohydrate gels an hour for my body weight on the bike.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, because it's calculated by your weight.
Oh,
so even my weight now, I'd still probably be looking at 4 or 5 gels an hour, right?
It's too much.
Now, you might as well just... But you might as well... You might as well just shit your pants at the start. You know, it's based... You're asking for a horribly upset stomach. You're asking for cavities in your teeth. Like you say, you're not going to digest most of it, even though you've got 4 hours in the marathon afterwards, because your body is not going to be focusing on food.
You're not going to absorb the carbs in that time frame. You're not going to get any, like, you can do like two carbs,
dude,
two gels an hour.
Dude, preaching to the choir. Like I say, I was looking at this, I was thinking, this is bollocks. This is just, this is the accepted wisdom. It doesn't make any sense. But anyway, those are the four goals. I might achieve none of them, but at least by getting my shoes on and going out there and giving it a go, I've made a start.
That's the key thing. That's the key thing.
Absolutely.
Dug out my Garmin.
Gadgets.
Dug out Terry Fox. Speaking of people that did things that were shitty and difficult and painful, Terry Fox trying to run across across Canada with one friggin' leg.
Who'd one leg?
He was the man.
Oh my God.
Dude, you not heard of Terry Fox, Pierre?
No, I haven't. I haven't. Who is he?
Okay, look him up. No word of a lie. Look him up. There's two or three books on this guy. If you know any Canadians, just mention Terry Fox to them. They will know exactly who he is. No word of a lie. They will know everything about him.
Yeah. I bet he's
every
super
town
polite
in Canada, every, every town in Canada has a road named after him. Loads of towns in Canada have statues of him. There's a mountain named after him. I think he was about 21 when he died. And yet that's the impact he had on a country. It's an extraordinary story.
Oh, wow.
I actually sent Fintan, there's a wonderful author called Douglas Coupland, and he did a book, and the book's actually aimed at high school kids, but so it's quite pictorial, but it's an absolutely beautiful book. I actually sent Fintan a copy. And it's just, you know, yeah, geez, what's that? I keep that around my neck. It's a, for anybody listening in black and white, it's a cutout of a Canadian loonie, the Terry Fox dollar. And a friend of mine drilled a hole in it, and he threaded a tiny, tiny saw in it, and he cut around Terry Fox so I can make a pendant out of it. And I keep it on me so that when I'm running, I can remind myself, at least I've got two legs.
Exactly. Could always be worse.
Could always be worse.
Absolutely.
But look him up, Pierre. Seriously, it's an incredible story.
Really cool. Yeah, it's so cool. But by the way, is there a correlation here? Like, it seems that we are like overrepresented in the gambling industry of people who do these like extreme things. Like Fintan, John, you guys, two guys. That is obviously Angus of BetMGM. There's James King of Flows. He's also around like the ultra marathon. Is there like
who's
a correlation?
Who's that lovely guy? Did the Dragon's Back we had on Fintan?
Oh, that was. That
was, he was great.
Early,
he was
that
lovely
was early fan. Days of the podcast, wasn't it? That's super early days. He was one of our first guests.
Yeah, he was supposed to go back and try it again, wasn't he? That's a tough fight. Oh, Pierre, there's a fucking hard race. The Dragon's Back.
Oh, my God.
That's
even the name.
That's an absolute beast. Yeah. Well, it's called that because it's in Wales.
Martin Holman of Augmentum Fintech.
He was great. We should contact him again, see if he's gone back.
Is there like a correlation of these like lunatics and people joining the gambling industry, do you think? Because it's also a bit of an extreme industry, right?
I think if you went to like a typical law firm or accountancy or banking.
Do you think the correlation is between a relatively high income and a certain age group?
Yeah, because
If you do triathlon, the age group 40 to about 55 is super, super competitive. So there's an age issue.
I think it's more an income, like, because the ability to be able to afford to do a 3 hour run or a 2 hour run, like the time being able to afford the time to train, it makes it a rich person sport. That's really the best way to describe it.
Yeah, that's for one. But I also feel like in order to even find your way to these races, you have to be a bit unorthodox as a human being. And to find yourself to the gambling industry, you also have to be a bit unorthodox, I suppose, because it's not exactly true. The first choice of industry to most like rational people, I think, for whatever reason, even though the industry is great, I think. But from the outside point of view, maybe not.
Yeah,
so much.
No, it's a good point. It's definitely got mixed reviews from the outside. So civilians, as I like to call them.
Yes. Civilians. Not putting yourself on a high horse at all.
You know, deal with it. You don't know. You weren't there.
Why don't we call them normies?
The normies.
There's a few other names, but we won't go there.
I'm disgusted.
So here you've
as one.
So you've got your event coming up in a few weeks. Do you want to give us a quick plug and see if we can shift some tickets for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the event is 21st, 22nd June. 4,000 people expected. We are kind of at the end of this marathon that we've now been running for the last year, trying to organize this event and put it together. Right. And I always, my coach, so I come from a martial arts background. And my coach always used to tell me that, Pierre, like, you always need to finish strong, you know, because the judges, when you're in a fight, they will see the ending of the fight. So you always have to finish strong. And so we're in this final part of that race now to Agamemnx Valletta. And things are coming together in a really rapid pace for that event. We have a big goal internally to try to sell the event out. So that's 4,000 delegates. And I've made a promise to my team that if we manage to complete that goal, I will dress out like our product manager, Gabby, who the closest you can compare her to is like Goldilocks. She's very, like, she's super blonde, very pretty Lithuanian girl. She's fantastic at what she does. She's like the best product manager ever. And so my promise to the team is I will dress like her if we manage to complete this goal. And so naturally, our team has never been more motivated to make this happen. So if you ever need any assurance that this is going to be a great event, then you can take that promise to my team as a sure sign that this is going to be an event not to miss, for sure. It's coming together good. It's going to be a fantastic event. Like, we have like quite a lot of cool speakers. The Prime Minister of Malta, Minister for Economy of Malta, Minister for Finance of Curaçao is traveling over, nice. together with the industry legends as well, of course. So there's not going to be a shortage of interesting people to talk to and fun things to do. And we're hosting a run club, but it's 5K, so it's digestible.
So you can join. How many people sign up for the run club and party so hard they never make run club?
Well, we put it on the first day for a reason. Okay, so we are smart.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, but it's an early one, right? It's like we start like 7 in the morning and it's a nice little run.
You don't want to be too hot. That's fine. That makes perfect sense.
Exactly. Yeah. Then we go for breakfast afterwards. So, perfect.
Lovely.
So yeah, it's gonna be a good run. So anyone who listens, for you guys, I really hope to have you guys there as well at some point. And I realized now when we set this up that you guys should obviously come on board as speakers for the future as well. If our team haven't reached out to you guys, we made a big mistake on that front. But we'd love to have you guys over.
I think I was asked to do something that you're doing later in the year in London.
Okay. Not sure if that's from us. Yeah. We don't do anything in London particularly. It's the Valletta and New York are the two. But again, I need to update that.
Or it was top secret, John, and you've just blown the lid off something you shouldn't be talking about.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe. Fuck, if I did, right. I'm sorry.
We have to restart the recording. Guys, sorry.
just very, very quickly, one thing. If I'm fit and well and able, then yeah, I'll totally come and do that ultra in Malta. And so will Fenton. And and we could podcast while we're doing it. I mean, obviously, I'm going to be fucking podcast. Miles away from you.
Yeah.
It'll to use radio mics.
It'll be like a David Goggins. It'll be like a David Goggins, but we'll be running.
Stay hard, motherfuckers.
yeah, exactly.
Who do you think you are? You can't let people talk down on you. Find out who you are, own that motherfucker, and tell people to go fuck themselves.
That's pretty much how I start my days. Just me in the mirror. And you know, people are like, where does all this confidence come from? I mean, short, you've got no hair. That's fucking where.
The accountability exactly. Mirror. Yeah.
From my mirror chats. Have you seen Cobra Kai?
Oh, it was so long ago. I don't even remember it, to be honest.
But you have seen it.
In when I was like 10 years old, but I don't even remember it, to be honest.
No. You're confusing the Karate Kid and Cobra Kai.
Okay. Oh yeah, maybe
Cobra Kai, Netflix. Oh. Available now. The final season appears this year.
Oh, okay.
Particularly yes. If you're into martial arts.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Well, then, absolutely. I'm writing it down.
They've got us on commission. We're just signing up viewers one by one.
We've made almost nothing from this. It's a passion play for us. It's like bodybuilding in Sweden.
Exactly. I would choose the podcast route.
Yeah, it pays more. Oh, no, hang on. Pierre Lind, co-founder and managing director of iGaming Next, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thanks, mate.
Been a pleasure, guys. Thank you so much for having me on.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just @GamblingFiles. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.